Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
20-year-old Moira, the daughter of a Newfoundland doctor, dreams of becoming a doctor herself. But when she becomes pregnant out of wedlock, she is banished to the bleak landscape of southern Saskatchewan in 1906. There she must come to terms with her predicament, her pioneer environment, and her employment as a dolly bird, a term applied to women who might be housekeepers, whores, or both. A saga of birth, death, and the violent potential of both men and the elements, Dolly Bird explores the small mercies that mean more than they should under a vast prairie sky that waits, not so quietly, for people to fail. Okay, there's the descriptor. We're delighted to greet the creator, of course, of Dolly Bird with us now, making her debut as author of the week. It's Anne Lazurko. How are you, Anne?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
It's an absolute delight. And got to say, an interesting text because, how would you describe this? Historical fiction? Historical romance? General life-affirming text of life under the prairies? Or is it a case of it's indescribable?
I think most people would describe it as literary historical fiction. But your last comment probably fits as well. Survival in a prairie settler community, if you like, and how very difficult that was, and all of the elements that come together to allow someone to actually make it in that situation.
I mean, we look now, and depending on your particular perception of time, 120 years, a little bit under 120 years, might seem an eternity. It might seem, well, it's just a couple of generations ago. Lots of things have changed. Lots of things have adjusted since clearly the start of the 20th century, as we look back on it from the 21st century. Was that something which, in terms of writing this novel, you kind of felt as though it was always a challenge to keep the objectivity there and actually write as though the reader is being transported, as I say, a little under 120 years ago?
I think that's always a challenge with historical fiction, you know, getting the time right and the idioms of the time, using them correctly within their historical context. And yes, it is sometimes difficult to keep yourself and the current time out of the work, if that makes sense, because you have opinions about how women were treated. You have opinions about how, a certain segment of society was treated at that time. And while you want to be careful not to, perpetuate those stereotypes or those kinds of things, you also have to be true to the time. So that's kind of the balancing act that you have to try and make whole to get this character and show people how it really was. And I think that's actually quite important to historical fiction, because if we try too hard to, make it, correct for our current time, we can't see how change has happened. For example, in this case, for women in those situations. That is a real balancing act.
As Laurie Gree Glenn Norris was quoted as saying in the Telegraph Journal, Dolly Bird explores human relationships, parents and children, men and women, siblings and female friends, and how these connections are further complicated in the face of an indifferent, unpredictable natural environment. That prairie sky element, that whole notion of the big sky, if you like, it is something that maybe in some ways it's quite challenging to really kind of appreciate the wow factor that is, and also the challenges that in many ways pioneers were actually having back in the day.
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of readers have said that, the landscape of Saskatchewan of early, well, even now, of Saskatchewan is almost like a character in the story. And I think, I don't know if I go that far, but I think it's very true that place in our lives and therefore in fiction or in any form of writing has a great effect on our character. And in terms of the prairies, I live on the prairies and we actually farm out here. So we're on, as I like to say, the bald ass prairie, much as Moira and Dylan are in this story. And it's very foreign to them. And for me, writing it, I could only imagine coming to this place with no electricity, with no natural gas heating systems, all of those kinds of things that we have now. But what I could do is stand on our deck and look out onto the prairie and think and imagine these people in this situation, and a lot of research as well. They about building sod huts back in the day and how they survived in the winter. And I mean, there's a lot of folklore here in Saskatchewan about surviving the elements, winter in particular, as most people have heard, we're very cold. In fact, yesterday we were minus 30, which is almost 40 below in Fahrenheit. So this book, it was relatively not easy, but I could imagine it and put these people in these situations. And I think that my characters both come from the East Coast of Canada. And I did that for a reason. So that partly so that I could see things newly, like imagine them seeing this new, so that I could write it more with greater clarity for the reader.
And of course, it certainly did the business. It received the Willa Award for Historical Fiction. It was shortlisted for the Saskatchewan Fiction Award. So again, congratulations on that. I mean, presumably the movie rights will already be in operation.
Wouldn't that be nice? I've had a lot of readers who, I think, just because of the nature of the story and it's a fairly, there's a lot of drama that happens because of the elements and what happens with these two characters, and other characters that are involved. And there's a bit of, there's a villain, and there's all of these elements that would make for a good movie. And so people have actually said that they think it would be a good movie, but so far no movie, right?
Oh, it'll happen with a great backdrop as well, and the location it's got to take place, certainly. But let's move back to the slightly younger Anne Lazurko. You have a political science degree from the University of Saskatchewan. You're an award-winning freelance agricultural journalist, and of course, as you've already said, you're a farmer as well from that perspective. Now, I'm probably more familiar with the agricultural scene in Britain, and it's not an easy life at the best of times. Now, that's in a relatively developed, hyper-intensified country where farmers, whether they are arable, whether they are livestock-based, whatever, they still have challenges with respect to that. So I can only imagine, in terms of what was the writing bug with you, even when you were writing freelance material and so on, did you always sort of feel, yeah, I've got a novel in there and I just need to nudge it out a little bit?
Interestingly enough, I was, I don't know, my dad tells me this, 10 years old or something, and I said, when I grow up, I want to write a novel and marry a farmer. And those things happened. So, this was back before I understood that I wanted other things out of life, of course. And I think I wasn't always a writer, but I was always a reader. I'm from a family of six girls, and we all would sit around in the evenings. Saturday night, Dad would be watching Hockey Night in Canada, and we'd be our nose buried in a book, that kind of thing. We read a lot, and so I've always been a reader. And as I got older, I was a editor of the university newspaper, and I was a journalist in a weekly newspaper before I got into agriculture, and that's another story. But so yeah, I've been writing, and when I started writing Dolly, like my whole life, and when I started writing Dolly Bird, I didn't know it was a novel because I had a bunch of kids. I was very busy, in my life, and I thought, well, I'm writing a short story. And as it turned out, it just got longer and longer. And then eventually I went, oh, look at this, I'm writing a novel. And it carried on from there. Now, since then, I've written another one and I'm working on a third, and I'm more focused on the actual act of writing a novel and getting it into the container that is a novel. But for Dolly Bird, it was a work in progress. And I had always been a member of the Writers Guild for years and taken courses and workshops and that sort of thing to hone my skills. And so when it was actually published, there had been a lot of pre-work that had gone into it, let's put it that way, to getting to the point where I could get a novel published. So that's kind of my trajectory as a writer, if you like.
Many writers that we speak to tend to be very definitely either poets or prose people. You seem to have straddled both of those fields. Do you have a preference? Do you occasionally like to wax lyrical with a bit of iambic pentameter thrown in? Or do you actually tend to think, no, I want to keep it to prose and keep it real?
I have written both and I've had both published. Somehow short stories, I have one short story published, but this I don't seem to, not yet anyway, I don't seem to manage that form that well. I really love poetry and I love to read it. And I actually like to write it in the in-between stages of novels, if you like. I think poetry has taught me to keep things succinct, that every word matters, those kinds of elements of poetry, and even just the language that, that you can use for metaphor and that sort of thing. You can really use that in fiction as well, and in prose. So I think they sort of help each other, but I do definitely tend more towards prose and fiction.
That's great. I mean, when I first sort of did a bit of research in terms of your background, Anne, I was fascinated to see you're a graduate of the Humber School of Writing. I thought, oh, that's unusual. I wasn't aware that we had a Humber School of Writing actually on Humberside in Britain, but presumably it's a different Humber.
It is, absolutely. It's out of Toronto. It's a university in Toronto, and they have a, thankfully, because I am thousands of kilometers away, they have a creative writing correspondence course, but it's an 8-month course and you work one-on-one with a mentor. And that was really a fabulous opportunity because I had a draft of Dolly Bird at that time. And so I could work through it with a mentor in the course. And that's where I really, got a sense of how I could put this thing together. Just all the elements of fiction, we went through in the course of that program, and so that was a wonderful opportunity. Yes, but it is in Toronto.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that because obviously there could be an interesting tie-up, I would have thought. Now, clearly, award-winning Dolly Bird, you followed that up with your second novel, of course, What Is Written on the Tongue, released April 2022. And this is completely different. This is a completely different area here. This is set in 1945 Indonesia. But once again, you have adopted the mantra of write about what you know. You did some interesting research in terms of this. So would you like to share with us in terms of how you started developing What Is Written on the Tongue?
Sure. Just so you know why I'm talking about it in the first place, it is set during the Indonesian War of Independence, which happened right after the Second World War. And part of the research or part of my knowledge of it is because my parents are Dutch and my dad was with Dutch forces in Indonesia for 3 years during that period. And they were trying to keep the colony as a Dutch colony and there was an independence movement. So that's the basis of the story, right? And so my dad was a huge, help in understanding sort of what he saw as happening there. And his story is completely different from my character in the novel. And then, of course, book research and, all of the normal ways that you do research. And then I traveled to Indonesia for a month with my sister to be part of. I couldn't have written the novel without going there, I felt, because I felt a bit of a fraud. And you need to feel that kind of heat. You need to, be in the jungle and see what that's like. you know, just some like a small thing. For example, my dad talked about the heat rashes and things like that that they would get. Well, we actually, my sister and I both got them while we were there, and we had air conditioning. So again, it's doing that kind of research so you can imagine the character in that situation and write them that way and be as accurately detailed as you can be.
I'm very impressed with the bibliography of what is written on the tongue. It's nicely referenced and appropriately put together, so it shows your academic training is to the fore there, which is always good. But I am intrigued by the notion of a little strapline on your website, which of course is annelazurko.com, exploring the transcendent possibilities of words. Would you just speak to us a little bit about that whole notion? Because I'm thinking that could be a little bit woo-woo in one sense, but on the other hand, maybe we do suffer perhaps too strong a word, but we do have this notion as human beings where when we do actually deal with the spoken word, the written word, and so on, we kind of use them in all sorts of ways, but are we ever really ensure that what we are endeavoring to communicate, what we mean, is what is being understood? And is that something you had in mind when you started talking about the transcendent possibilities of words?
Yes, I think so. I think words can be transcendent if they speak for themselves. And that might sound a little woo-hoo, actually, but one of the things that I talk about in my new book and what is written on the tongue is the use of language and how language is used to by people in all kinds of ways, and not just in situations of extreme things like war, but whatever capacity we are using it in to further our own aims, to redeem us, to make excuses, to, you know, all of these kinds of ways. And I just think I'm not saying that my words can are transcendent and can go beyond that, but it's something that we can strive for with language. And Benedict Anderson has this fabulous, you know, review or what's the word I'm looking for? He talks about one of the stories by an Indonesian writer, and that whole idea that language slips the knot that ties it to meaning. And I love that phrase because it allows us to use language in all kinds of ways that don't make sense. If we look at the world right now and the hyper partisanship, the hyper all the talk about divisions and those kinds of things, I think it's important for us to use language as best we can and as clearly as we can for what we want it to say. Does that sound too
No, I
woo-hoo?
think it actually addresses the whole notion of the weaponization of language and other issues that we're faced with very effectively. And maybe we need to obviously demonstrate that as a human species, we do have the maturity to transcend some of those initial responses that come through. However, let's talk processes. And in terms of processes, people have different sort of aspects. Many writers t say that they like to have a soundtrack when they're working. They like to have some music in the background. Some prefer complete silence. Some prefer to effectively communicate with their characters as though they are their best friends, and they perk up every so often with ideas within that. Do you have any particular approaches that you've taken to either of your first two novels, which you tend to think, actually, that's worked, I might stick with that? Or equally, you might turn around and say, I do, but I don't want to share them.
I'm not that shy about talking about things. I think I'm a very much I have to have quiet around me. I can listen to classical music when I'm doing research and that sort of thing. But if I'm actually in the creative process of writing, then I need it to be quiet, to get there. And that might be a function of having had a very busy household, and now I can have quiet to work in because my kids have grown, and you know, so I have my own space, so to speak. But that part is quite critical to me. I don't have, things on my desk that help me to get my muck together in terms of writing and that sort of thing. I don't believe for myself that my characters have a role in the writing, that sort of stuff. For me, it's more I need to know my characters really well through a really well-written character sketch. A really in-depth character sketch allows me then to put them on the page and know how they're going to react in a given situation, if that makes sense. You know, if I know the character really well and something happens, they're not going to suddenly go veer off into some other realm, right? That what they do just makes sense based on their character, and then I can write it that way. And that's not always good things, right? Your characters have to have all the sides and angles of a human being. And so sometimes, especially in what is written on the tongue, my main character ends up doing things that I really didn't want him to have to do, but that made sense for the character and the plot, you know? And in that regard, another process thing is to have some kind of chart. There's one on the wall behind me for my new book that I'm working on. Some kind of container for the novel that allows me to see its arc, and see how things and how events and characters interact, so that I have a visual of it. That really helps me a lot. So that's a process that I've learned over time works really well for me.
So in terms of characters, then there's no chance that you would actually see, let me do a quick calculation here, a 62-year-old Moira actually encountering the characters from your second novel, or interlinking in any way. You're not looking to create a universe, a shared universe of material.
No, they are, well, especially those two books, they're so completely different. That would be a huge leap. but I
it
think
it could be a challenge, Anne. It could be a challenge you could rise to, I'm sure.
Yeah, for sure. That would be a challenge. I think within each story, though, there is a universe that that you create for those characters within that realm of that particular story. And I'm not saying they're not real to me, but they just don't direct my process. Let's put it that way. You know, I know some writers will say that, you know, the characters sort of tell them how and I just that is too woohoo for me. But but whatever works for people, I'm not critical of that. It's just not something that you know, I would say works for me.
Would Moira be somebody you would like to have befriended? Somebody that effectively you could have related to in times gone by? Or is it a case of, no, I was completely objective and very academic, and she was simply just a cipher that I was actually developing as the novel proceeded?
Oh, no, I really like her. I think that she... I could really relate to her. Like I said, I have five sisters, and the book is actually dedicated to my oldest sister. And it says, for my sister who chooses to find joy. And I think that was really critical for me, that Moira was really able to work through and move past the challenges. And because I've seen that with my sisters and my own family and friends and just women in my life who are really strong people. And that is one thing about Moira, is she's very strong. And of course, she has her ups and downs, and life hits her upside the head and she has to deal with things. But she has that very strong spirit that kind of was almost critical to a settler mentality, given the extreme elements they were coming to and that sort of thing. And not that she chose it necessarily, but that's what ended up happening. So, you know, so yeah, I think she's a mixture of women that I know, and that I think made me really fond of her as I was writing her.
In terms of, again, the writing process, we still, surprisingly enough, even in the 21st century, have a number of writers who prefer to use longhand in terms of their notes, in terms of their overall aspect from that. Are you somebody who likes to hit the keyboard immediately? Do you have a hyper drive system which effectively sort of translates all sorts of other areas? Or dare I say it, do you still have a fondness for the electric typewriter?
I used to think that having an electric typewriter again would be great because there wouldn't be the distractions, you know, from other programs on your computer and email and all of those things. But I've I've really embraced my computer because A, I have terrible handwriting, and I just think it's so much easier, especially in a work of length like a novel, with all the research that it entails and all that sort of thing. It's just so much easier to organize your stuff, and also to be able to look back at portions of the novel and move them around if you need to and that sort of thing. Although I do always print out whatever I'm working on, I have to see it visually. So the printed version I need to see, and then I can edit, and when I'm in the editing process, and move things around, and then I can go back and do it on the computer. But as far as handwriting, no, I don't. I mean, I make notes here and there, obviously, but it's all on computer. And I do use a program called Scrivener, which is very helpful to me with what is written on the tongue, and now this new one, are quite research heavy. So to organize that information, that program really helped a lot. So I use that as well.
We have emerged from the era of the pandemic, and clearly conventions, book tours, and so on are progressing. You had obviously a couple of sessions in November, I see, in Anne Le Zirko's Alberta Book Tour, both in Edmonton and Calgary. I always think of the Calgary Stampede when we start talking about Calgary, but that's a different line. Is that something that you enjoy with respect to obviously meeting other authors at events or meeting readers and so on? Or is it a case of, well, I'll do it under sufferance?
I really enjoy it because I think, when you're in the process of writing, you're doing it, you just, for me, it's kind of detrimental to think about our reader out there. Like, for me, you just need to write what you're writing and hope it, gets out there and people enjoy it. But once it's out there, to engage with readers is, I find, a really gratifying thing to do, because whether it's a reading where they show interest, I mean, they haven't read the book, so they might show interest in it, and you can explain what it's about and that sort of thing, or with book clubs, or people that have read the book, or interviews like this, you get to really explore it more in depth and see what other people got out of it. And sometimes it's surprising what other people get out of your work that you didn't necessarily intend and that sort of thing. So I really love that engagement. And at festivals and those sorts of things, it is really lovely to meet other writers and talk about writing and the work and those sorts of things, as well as, engage with the public and readers and the industry and those kinds of things. So I'm a fairly social person too. So I think it's a nice, for me, it's like a reward after sitting at my desk for years.
Well, there is, of course, the classic Roland Barthes death of the author, the notion that once the book has actually been released into the public domain, effectively the audience will make of it what they will and come back with a whole variety of interpretations, which is, I suppose, part of the interaction. Who were your own favourite authors? Did you have any as a child? Do you have any now where you sort of think, yes, I need to actually have a good look at James Michener or other sort of folk before I can even make a start on this?
As a young person, I read, sort of embarrassingly, like Nancy Drew and those ones, I liked what young people and teenagers all liked. Not embarrassingly, like, that's a bad thing to say, but you know what I mean. And I have to say, like, I've read, I've done, English Lit in university and those kinds of things, and I really appreciated learning about those authors, whether it was, an American Lit class or an English Lit class, and those, authors who came before. But I really love the authors I read now are all contemporary. I have to say that. Barbara Kingsolver, Sheila Hedy, Pure Color is just fabulous. And I just, I'm trying to think, Miriam Taves, a lot of Canadian authors that I really appreciate. And I like to support as well, Madeleine Tien, Guy Vanderhaeghe. There's a lot of Canadian authors, contemporary authors that I really, really appreciate. And I don't think I try to emulate so much as appreciate and see how they do things. Not that when I read fiction, I'm all in. Like, I just read and I'm not looking at it as a writer, unless something, you know, I just go, wow, that is incredible. How did they do that? But I'm into the story and that sort of thing. And so I think as far as influences, maybe that makes me odd, but I don't have that many in the, you know, sort of in the literary world of or, if that makes sense.
Well, I think these days we're also interested in the whole notion of how artificial intelligence is beginning to actually churn out more and more material. Hopefully we won't be seeing you replaced by an algorithmic program before too long, Anne, because that would be dreadful. But that's just a by the by.
Agreed.
Let's move back on to the book International Market, of course, from that point of view. You mentioned, obviously, you've got Dutch parentage, and there's backdrop from that point of view. Do you travel over to Europe? Is it an area that you like to visit? Are there countries that you think, yeah, I really should actually do a session in Italy or indeed the British Isles or whatever? Any thoughts on that one?
I'm most of my extended family is in Holland, because both my parents came here in 51. And so, you know, I have a lot of cousins. And so I've traveled to Europe on, you know, a number of occasions, to see them. And I've been, you know, to a variety of countries for different reasons. So yes, I do like to travel there, and I do find it extremely interesting to visit Holland and you know, see, it sounds odd, but see, you know, gravestones with my family name on them that don't exist here, because I'm a first generation Canadian, basically, right? And my dad is 97 now, and my mom passed away a couple of years ago, so it's really very, really very interesting to go there and meet these people who are my family. As far as other, you know, more travel, I interesting you mentioned Italy, because I'm going to Italy in May to walk 180 kilometers of the Way of St. Francis there as research for the new book I'm working on. My husband likes to say that I only write these novels so I can travel, and maybe he's not far wrong. But that's coming up, and we're going to walk, you know, for 2 weeks there, and then go to Rome and go up the coast a bit. And I need to go to Germany to there 10 days as part of this trip, for other research. So yeah, I don't know why my books end up being set in these various locations, but that seems to be happening. So yeah.
Well, in the words of St. Francis, of course, make me a channel of your peace, where there is darkness, let me sow light, which is to a certain extent what authors do to a large extent in various ways. If we could actually use the wonderful world of a time machine to travel back to the young Anne Lazurko, the young lady who effectively was wanting to marry a farmer and write a book and a novel, those have all been ticked and checked off. What would you say to her now?
That's an interesting question. Well, I think I would say way to go. but also, I would say both of those things, and raising a family, are much harder than you think when you're a young person and dreaming about the transcendent possibilities of words, as we were talking about earlier. It's much harder to make those things happen and real and work. And I think at this point, you know, I'm older. So
chronologically gifted, Anne, is the term we tend to use.
There we go. Yeah. But now with my children, you know, gone from home, and you know, we are, as you were talking about with travel, able to go a little bit more and that sort of thing. We're still farming, but I can really focus my time now. And that's quite a different thing than when I was younger. And I've worked through a lot of that tough stuff that I didn't know back then. That actually is great now in terms of writing, because there's a certain amount of wisdom, I hope, that comes with, you know, having had a family and done all these different things in your life. So that finds its way into the writing that I would not have known back then. And I guess I would have told my younger self to just be prepared and to trust your instincts and to make sure you do that thing that you want to do, and or to the best of your ability anyway.
Absolutely. In terms of contacting your good self or following you online, is annelazurko.com the best place to go to? Are you on all the socials as well? Is there a series of TikTok videos that you've actually hidden as yet about to be released to the world?
No, I have not, and probably won't. But yeah, you can go to my website, or I am on Facebook and Instagram, just Ann Lazurko. You can find me there. And also there's a page, a Facebook page for Dolly Bird, if you want to know more about that book, or find out where you can get it, that sort of thing. And and the books are everywhere.
Fantastic.
You can get them in all formats, and they're found wherever you get your books. So I'm happy for that to have happened.
We might indeed be utilizing Dolly Bird as one of our upcoming Book of the Month programs as well. So that's another aspect to savor. Anyway, it's brought us around to two final questions, critical ones, these, in many ways, but they need to be asked. So first of all, Anne, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on this, your debut as Author of the Week on Siren Radio and Southside Broadcasting?
It's been wonderful. Very, 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 very interesting, and great, a great discussion. And yeah, it has been very wonderful. Thank you.
Okay, well, that's good for that. And the second question is, can we prevail upon you to come back? Will you be able to join us again from either Saskatchewan, Italy, Germany, wherever you happen to be? Will you be kind enough to return?
I would, absolutely. I would.
Anne Lazurko, huge thanks, and keep on writing.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care.
Thank you.